You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
So it has been a while since I've read a book that wasn't intended for children under 10 years old. And so it may be partially that, but I really think it's the content of this book that got me so excited. The Steve Rickard, the head of the D.C., of our Washington, D.C. Advocacy office, wrote me a few weeks ago and said that he went to a talk about that Kathleen did at the New America Foundation. And he said, this book is amazing. And it has so much relevance to what we do at OSF. I think many, if not all of you, have heard me or other GMSG colleagues talk over the last few years about organization-centered grant making, and that the idea of focusing more attention on organizations before we focus on projects is part of a vision of trying to help the groups, the anytime two or more people come together to make change or defend change or stop horrible things from happening, they are all of a sudden in an organization, right? And that organizations, people working together, is, we all agree, the way that change happens in the world, right? Rarely does a single person acting alone actually have an impact, or that's the myth of social change in our world. And this book really does an amazing job of focusing on some of the factors that Kathleen has found over the course of her work and her study to understand how organizations become effective or are effective over time. And so my hope is that today we can hear about some of those things. We have copies of the book. We will send it to you or get it to you, Dani and Sanjukta. In Barcelona, and Joanna, I'll bring you a copy next week. But really excited that Kathleen could take time on her tour of the East Coast to talk about this. So thanks and welcome.
Thank you so much.
So I'd love to hear first about what got you to write this book.
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Tom, for having me. It's really an honor to be here presenting this work at OSF, which has done such phenomenal work on so many of the issues that I care so deeply about in the world. So thank you all for your important work. It's funny because I was on the phone with Tom this morning when I came to meet him with my 5-year-old, 3-year-old, and 2-year-old, because there had been an all-out revolt in our house. Nobody was going to school, and this is what happens when mommy goes away on book tour for a few weeks. So it's been 5 weeks since the book came out, so they're getting a little bit restless. But interestingly, the question that I get asked on the book trail most often is, why on earth did you decide to write a book during the time when you were having 3 children in 3 years? And it's a good question my husband often asks me as well. But the answer is always the same, that this work matters, that everyone around the table cares about social change work, and we are all doing our part to make a difference. The problem is, as so many of us have experienced, that not all organizations are created equally to solve the massive social problems that we're facing today. And I thought I would start by talking about an organization that really embodies one of the reasons why I wrote this book, which is Rob Gitton, who founded At the Crossroads. He was a student at Stanford, where I teach social entrepreneurship, and he, like many of my students, chose his class schedule based on the classes that met after 2 p.m. because he liked to sleep in. So he stumbled literally into this class one day called Homelessness in America, and he quickly fell in love for the class. He was asked to go out and volunteer with homeless youth in San Jose, and so he was spending all of his nights and weekends with these kids who had been let down at every single stage of their lives, whether it was by their families, by the foster care system, by the juvenile justice system, and he really took a lot of pleasure in helping them get back on their feet. And so after he graduated, he started at the Crossroads, his organization, really as a self-employment plan, which is how, sadly, a lot of organizations get started. And he was able to get the Echoing Green Fellowship, and he was able to start doing this work as his job in San Francisco, walking the streets of the Tenderloin literally between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. all night long, helping work with these kids. And so he was helping kids one by one by one, when he realized that one by one by one wasn't going to get him very far, and that if he wanted to really make a difference, he was going to have to build a much bigger organization to reach the thousands of homeless youth in San Francisco that really needed his attention. The problem is that Rob was 22, and he had never been hired before, let alone hired anyone himself. He did not have any connections to high net worth individuals or foundation funders to raise the millions of dollars that he needed to get his organization off the ground. And he had no idea where to start measuring his impact. He didn't want to turn his kids into data points. And so he resisted data and impact measurement, even though he knew that was going to be necessary to track the impact of his work. And so Rob's story is really indicative of so many young, eager social change makers who get into this work because they care about the work and the problems that they're trying to solve. But they realize that this passion and charisma is only going to get them so far. And I know about this story myself because it was my story. I co-founded an organization called Spark to engage young professionals in gender equality issues and new forms of philanthropy to support the women's movement. And I was a lawyer by day, and I spent my nights starting this organization, and it was amazing. We had a ton of buzz. We had lines around the blocks for our events, and we became actually the largest network of millennial donors in the world. We had 10,000 people in our network. Despite all of this, we hit a wall just as we hit our stride. At $500,000 in revenue, we couldn't get the capital that we needed to grow. And I learned doing this research project at Stanford that actually two-thirds of nonprofits are $500,000 and below in revenue. And many of these organizations should stay small, community-based organizations. There will always be a place for mom-and-pop shops in the nonprofit world. But many of them had incredible ideas that were dying on the vine because they were flailing, trying to just make payroll every month, as opposed to really focusing on the impact of their work and the substance of their work. So for the past 5 years, I have been researching this question: why is it that some organizations succeed and scale and others don't? And I have surveyed hundreds of nonprofit organizations. I've traveled the country meeting with 100 social entrepreneurs, their staff, their beneficiaries, their funders, all to get to the bottom of this question. And in my interviews, I kept waiting for someone to say, well, it's just, you know, charisma or a great idea that gets someone ahead or doesn't. And no one said that. And it's not to say that charisma and a great idea aren't important, but it really comes down to these strategies: testing, measuring impact, funding experimentation, collective leadership, and storytelling that lay the foundation for success. And so to me, as I think about my goal for social startup success, this is the playbook that I wish I had when I co-founded Spark. It's the playbook that my Stanford students have been asking me for years. And it's an opportunity for the sector to get better at some of these very fundamental organizational strategies that will help organizations be more efficient in their work so that they can spend their time tackling the social problems that we all care so much about.
Thanks. Just so, I should have done this at the beginning, but I have a couple of questions, and then we'll open it up for everybody to ask questions. And we have until 1:15 to do it, so we have a little less than an hour at this point. I'd love to hear, kind of, the book really focuses on U.S. based organizations and a lot of organizations that are doing service delivery. At OSF, we fund mostly outside the U.S. and we're funding a lot of human rights work. And I wonder, like, what you learned in the course of this book about that, those specific niches of this world.
Yeah. So my background is actually in human rights. I was a young human rights lawyer and was running the International Human Rights Clinic at Stanford Law School, where I was taking students to do human rights projects in Southern Africa and Namibia and South Africa, Zimbabwe. And so I'm very, very familiar with human rights, passionate about human rights. I've been involved with Human Rights Watch for many years, and it's kind of a funny irony that this book focuses locally because my expertise is global, but when I was writing this book, I was pregnant for 2/3 of the time, so I was limited in my travel. What I found actually interestingly, as I have gotten this in front of more global audiences, I'm going to speak in China and Bangkok next month and other places around the world, and is that a lot of organizations are very interested in what global organizations are interested in what U.S. organizations are doing, and that actually the translation is something that they can do themselves on how these principles apply. But a lot of organizations are looking to how U.S.-based organizations are doing things like measuring the impact of their work, which has been in large part donor-driven in the U.S. economy, where a lot of tech donors have come out and said, well, we want more metrics. And that has, you know, been a positive thing in helping organizations to become more impactful. So I'm finding that the international, because so many global organizations are competing for U.S. funding, that they have to be aware of these best practices just as well as U.S.-based organizations.
Thanks. And what about the human rights space, right? Like, one of the sections that I found most interesting in this book is about testing ideas and measuring impact. It's two different sections of the book. But this idea of, you know, trying something, seeing how it works, et cetera. By the end of this section, I had already gone online and signed up for a human-centered design course. It's very compelling. It's free, by the way, if you want to sign up for it with me. How does that sort of thing, kind of testing of ideas and innovative approaches, operate in the human rights space particularly? Where have you seen that happen effectively?
Well, what's interesting is I think we forget that the human rights movement is still so young. I mean, the human rights movement is a test in and of itself. Like, this idea that we can apply these broad principles in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to governments is something that has only been a little over 50 years old. And so the organizations that are promoting this work are testing out ways to do that in the local context in governments, vis-a-vis governments around the world. And that is ultimately the essence of social entrepreneurship, of nonprofits, is how can we, organizations themselves will never scale solutions in and of themselves. That we require governments to scale solutions like on education, on anti-poverty initiatives, and in human rights. Ultimately, our goal is to get human rights, to get governments to adhere to human rights. And so the role of small organizations is to push governments in that direction. So an example is an organization that I work closely with, Accountability Council. I was the founding board chair, is working to hold literally trillions of dollars accountable, development money where companies have impinged upon human and environmental rights of grassroots communities around the world. So it's Accountability Council is a group of lawyers that helps represent these communities in claims at international financial institutions. The work that they're doing is testing one avenue for holding that money accountable. And Accountability Council is constantly testing new ways that the situation, the financing is constantly changing. I mean, the World Bank is now competing with China for development loans. And so Accountability Council has to be testing in China to figure out, you know, how they can hold Chinese banks accountable in the same way. And so all organizations, this idea of testing is critical because we cannot fall in love with the solutions and continue to work on these solutions for years and years and years without examining them in the context of the broader political and economic environment that we're living in. It's changing. And so organizations have to be nimble, and organizations can be nimble. That's the beauty of nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. One of the other chapters that I found really interesting is about leadership and leading collaboratively. And you talk about leaders themselves. You talk about the role they have with their governing bodies. In the U.S., that's typically a board. What did you learn about kind of, and I'm asking this in part because as I was reading it, I was thinking about the many conversations we've had at GMSG with people about trying to do organizational assessments and understanding the leadership and management parameter, right? What, when you go and meet an organization, you can say who the leader is, you can say what their background is, but getting at that, like, what are we looking for when we want to understand the leadership and management of an organization is often something that's feels a bit mysterious or out of reach. So when you have, with the various leaders you've met, what are the things that you're looking for that really you think contribute to effective leadership and management of an organization?
Well, one of the things that I've seen is that so many leaders, like Rob Gitton, are left to learn these very practical management skills on the job. And so things like learning how to hire and fire, learning how to empower your employees, learning the importance of leveraging your board of directors. You know, those are all things that organizations are often learning as they go. So some of the best practices that I talk about that I saw in organizations, one is this idea of collective leadership and looking at how to build up the team. I talk about Kiva is a great example. Kiva started in 2004, right around the same time as Spark in San Francisco. It's a crowdfunding platform for micro enterprises around the world. And Jessica Jackley and Matt Flannery, her then husband, were on the Oprah Winfrey Show, which that's a great strategy for success if you can get it. They raised $11 million overnight and literally broke their servers and had no choice but to rely on a collective leadership structure because they didn't have time to have this kind of top-down hierarchy. And so they had literally hundreds of volunteers who were helping them go into the field and assess whether the programs were being successful. And they incorporated things like horizontal feedback with their employees as opposed to more vertical, high top-down feedback. And so this is really the direction that organizations are going, that this traditional hierarchy, this pyramid that we think of in corporate structures has been flipped over, because everyone is in this work because they care about social change and they want to see how their work is contributing to the mission. So the more that organizations can empower their staff to be part of the mission, the better. Senior leadership is also critical. Organizations that tended to scale more quickly in my survey tended to say that a big catalyst for their growth was hiring that senior leadership early on, and this was what gave them the opportunity to focus on the strategy and the fundraising to help them grow. And I think so often organizations get stagnate because they don't want to take that risk to hire the chief operating officer, chief program officer, or maybe the chief technology officer, can depend on the structure of the organization, but ultimately having that senior team in early is critical. And then finally, having a really strong board of directors can be an important catalyst to growth. And knowing how to leverage the board of directors effectively, as opposed to so often nonprofit leaders think of boards as burdensome, you know, and organizations are frustrated with their boards. But the organizations that are able to rely on those boards and develop board structures are ultimately much more effective in accessing donor money, in developing better partnerships, and ultimately feeling more supported as leaders.
Okay, thanks. One last question, then I'll open it up for others, is, as I was reading this, one thing I thought is it's a book called Social Startup Success, but it made me think time and again, most of the organizations that we fund are not startups. We fund a lot of startups, and we, in fact, have Beth Dunlap who runs our new enterprise work within the strategy unit to really think through how we engage with the many startups, both those that emerge out of OSF and those that are external from the beginning. So we think about this, but so much of what we do is funding organizations that are already 2, 3, 10, 15 years into existence. How do the kinds of things that you've learned about in this book apply in that context? And what have you learned about the specific challenges of trying to live some of these things in an organization that may not have had them from the beginning?
It's really hard to shift a culture. I mean, it's a lot easier to implement some of these things, like developing key performance indicators for success and leadership structures and a board culture from the beginning, than to have to go back and change it later on. But the reality is that the nonprofit sector is modernizing in many ways. Impact measurement is a perfect example, is that organizations are getting better at measuring their impact. And if you can't get on that train as a nonprofit organization, you're gonna die. And so organizations do need to figure out how to be more effective no matter what stage they're at. And it's not easy. So I'll give you an example. Sam Cobbs came in as a CEO of an organization in the Bay Area called First Place for Youth, which is an organization to transition foster care youth into independent living. And Sam, the first thing he asked his team when he came in is, how do we know that what we're doing is successful, is having an impact? And his team came back to him and said, well, when the kids come back, they hug us. And Sam wasn't very satisfied with that answer, because he realized that if he was going to grow this organization and have the most impact that he possibly could, he was going to have to get his staff not only to collect data, but to care about the data that they were collecting. And so he started creating mantras like, if you're not documenting it, you're not doing it, you know, to try and change the culture. And his staff pushed back on him. They said, you know, we went to school to help kids. We didn't go to college to collect data. And so during that time period, he had a turnover of 70% in order to, you know, change the culture of the organization. But today, First Place for Youth knows that what they're doing works, and they have the data to prove it. And they are an organization that is focused on constantly improving their impact. And as a result, they know that if a youth comes through their programs, they're 20% less likely to end up on the streets than the broader population. So this is these are the challenges that organizations face when they have culture shifts within their teams. But ultimately, we have to think about how we can be improving organizations, because and providing leaders with the capacity to make these shifts. I mean, Sam Cobbs didn't do that alone. He did it with funders who provided data infrastructure for him, who provided capacity building support so that he could figure out how to measure his impact, with unrestricted grants so that he could invest in the data, and with patient capital so that he could take the time that he needed to get it right. And so funders play a really critical role in helping organizations to be better at what they do. And there's a lot of strategies that funders can implement to be those supportive partners.
Great. Thank you. At some level, that was the big takeaway in reading the book for me, is how much, what can we do at OSF to help organizations be able to test and fail and learn to assess their work, to invest in leadership, in terms of leadership that's not just about building up your team, but also helping leadership and other members of the organization really survive in many ways, survive burnout, avoid burnout. And all of those things lead back to one answer, which is providing organizations with more flexible funding and providing organizations, when we make project grants, with the full cost of overhead that those organizations need. It's something that we don't do and don't think about very often, especially on the overhead side of things, right? We're currently doing some research within GMSG to understand this. And we're often paying 10% overhead when organizations, especially grassroots organizations, often have overhead rates of like 70% because of the structure of their organization. But we as a foundation, and we're typical of all funders on this, see overhead as a bad thing. See it as something we should avoid paying, not that we should be looking forward to paying, because it allows organizations to do this thing. So anyway, I'll get down off the soapbox.
I'll just add one other point to close the loop on our friend Rob Gitten, who has scaled his organization in the city of San Francisco and is now a $2 million organization serving hundreds of homeless youth on the streets of San Francisco every year. And, you know, as I think about Rob Gitten's story, I think it really emulates this problem that we face, which is we are putting young people out into the world to run these organizations without the tools that they need to face the challenges that ultimately come up when you're starting any organization. And so, you know, we think about Rob Gitten. Well, it took him 20 years to get to this point. What if he had a funder by his side who was giving him that capacity building support early on and giving him that unrestricted capital that he needed to avoid so many of those inevitable mistakes that he made over the course of 20 years? I think we're a sector that is starved for resources generally, and we're starving the organizations even more at the expense of long-term impact.
Great. So, questions, thoughts? I see Jason and Kate, and we'll look to the screen. Joanna. Jason, Kate, Joanna, Sandy, and then we'll go back around. Go ahead, Jason, please.
Hey, thank you so much. I look forward to reading the book, and it seems like an amazing level of research and time.
Thank you.
So you mentioned several examples of organizations like that work with homelessness, education. It seems some kind of service-oriented organizations. Just want to ask you a question about the flip side on like the policy, things that may be harder to measure, such as policy change, cultural change. This is something that I'm just dealing with a lot of grantees, and I don't see any clear, you know, funders are going back and forth on debates on this in terms of when you think about healthcare fight and how many organizations contributed to that, and being able to measure your level of contribution to that win and pushback versus others, or cultural change, where you're trying to change how, you know, Black people or women or others are depicted in media or other things like that. Mm-hmm. What have you seen regarding kind of this model in measuring in relationship to something that I think is harder to measure and therefore harder to make a case?
It's a huge challenge in the sector. And, you know, it's funny because as an advocate of human rights, I find myself often like advocating the side of, don't be so hard on human rights organizations. You know, they're measuring long-term impact, and we need to focus on, on all problems, not just the ones that seem more solvable, like, you know, delivering vaccines to kids in Africa. But I feel like in front of this group, I have I have to take the other side of it, which is that, you know, yes, I absolutely agree that there are that it is harder to measure culture change, to measure policy change, and that these are long-term gains. I don't think that it gives the organizations, the human rights organizations that we care so deeply about, a hall pass from trying to figure out key performance indicators for whether they are on track toward achieving change. So, you know, there's a lot of really creative ways that you can do that. Like, you know, first of all, putting the structure in place for organizations to measure that impact. So Accountability Council, the organization that I told you about earlier, spent 2 years developing a theory of change to be really, really clear about what their activities were, what their ultimate outcome that they wanted to see, and then all of the intermediary steps that had to happen in order to get there. I think most organizations are really good about talking about their program activities. They're really good about talking about the goals, not so good about making those links between the two. And that is where the key performance indicators come in, is that once you have that clear theory of change, then you can break that down into indicators of whether you are on track toward success. And then it's just about being creative. You know, it's like thinking about things like, you know, the Center for Youth Wellness wanted to shift the conversation around adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress. They started measuring Google searches on ACEs to see like that sort of path, like more and more people talking about ACEs meant that that they were having a culture change. And so getting creative about trying to understand your metrics is an important introspection that organizations need to go through.
I think one thing you talked about in the book that illustrates that more is you really emphasize that not all metrics are quantitative,
yes.
Right? That it may often be that you want to do surveys, that you want to take the radical step of going and talking to the people that you claim to, that an organization claims to be trying to represent,
yeah.
And just ask them, right? Don and Jay Kakade from PHP, who recently left OSF, talked about this as a kind of key. He liked to himself go out when he was in various places and talk not to just to grantees but to the communities that they represented, and hear like, do you know this organization? Do you know about this work? Not necessarily like, do you know they issued this report? They did, but like, how are you experiencing this? And I think you talk about, you have examples of how organizations have used,
yes.
Surveys or other things to get yes. Knowledge about
100%.
Their impact.
And the bottom line is that it's both. You know, so much of what human rights organizations and democracy organizations do is not measurable, like building trust with communities and creating those relationships. But every organization can figure out the things that they can measure and go after them rigorously. So that's the balance, is figuring out what you can get to.
Did you want to follow up?
No.
Okay, great. Kate?
Hi, so my name is Kate Lapham, and I work with the education program here at OSF. And I also have a question about data and measurement. I think in my own work, I have a discomfort around evaluation data, especially the sort of big data, randomized controlled trials, very sort of rigorous quantitative research, for two reasons. One is that I worry that perhaps we're entrenching privilege, and what we're finding are not the best programs, but actually the organizations that have the technical capacity to do that kind of research and to present it well and to be respected for it, and who come from the same traditions of knowledge production as I do and as the foundation does. And then the second reason is I've spent a lot of my career working in international development, and I've seen the really perverse incentives that this type of data creates to declare every program successful. And not just a little bit successful, but sort of wildly successful, because your fundraising depends on your ability to do that, as does if you're working with a multilateral or a government donor, their ability to go back to their constituents and explain that they're only funding the best, most innovative, successful things. And so I'm wondering, how do you deal with that in the research?
I'm so glad you raised this question. This has become the question that keeps me up at night after writing this book, because the reality is that a community-based leader who doesn't have access to networks, who doesn't have, you know, the same kind of language around innovation or impact measurement, could do everything in social startup success and still not get funded. And that is a problem with our system. And it is a big part of the problem is the education system. I mean, if you look at what it takes to get an organization off the ground in the US at least, it's a pitch competition at a university, or maybe you can be lucky enough to get an Echoing Green fellowship. There's very little seed funding for early stage organizations. And the reality is that if you are someone who has grown up in a poor community, it is a huge luxury to say, I'm just going to take 6 months off and test out this idea and try and see if I can get it off the ground. And so as a result, what does that mean for your pipeline, further downstream for organizations that already have proof of concept, is that many of the stories sound very much the same. They're Ivy League, graduates who have started organizations who, which inevitably leads to racial bias and bias against, community-based advocates who are arguably in a much better position to solve problems in their community, but maybe haven't walked through the halls of the Ivy League. And so what do we do about this as a sector? I think it's a both and. It's not that it means that we need to have lower standards for some of these best practices, like measuring impact, like developing strong programs for testing ideas within organizations. But I think it does mean that we need to double down on supporting leaders who don't have a typical background, like we see so many of these leaders who are getting having success, and providing them capacity building. So providing them executive coaches and investing in their leadership and management skills, giving them support around impact metrics and getting help connecting them with universities who can help them with some of these, the survey development or the developing metrics in their organizations. I could go on and on and on about this, but I think it's a really important point. And I think that, in a way, you all have, because you're funding later, downstream, you're kind of left with what's already in the pipeline. And so I think that the investment has to start earlier on.
Joanna in London.
Hi, my name's Joanna Oyedo, and I work in the Grant Making Support Group. I wanted to ask you, you talked about the lack of resources in the sector proportionate to the number of startups and people who have good ideas. So I guess the flip side of successful is unsuccessful. And how long do you think as a donor, what should we be looking for in thinking about when we should walk away from supporting a startup? And after how long?
If I only had the answer to that question. I think this is where I was giving a talk. I'm from a small town in Napa, California, and have been involved in nonprofits there my entire life. And so it's been fun to go back and give back in my own community. And, I got this question at a small foundation, a local-based foundation, where it was the foundation officers were in the room with the local nonprofits, and someone asked this question, and all the nonprofits are biting their fingers, which one is he talking about? Is it me? And the challenge in a small town is that these people have to go walk and see each other in the aisles of Safeway or of the supermarket. So but my answer there, and I think applies to you all on a much bigger scale as well, is that the more that you can make it metrics based, the more that you can ensure that organizations are rigorous at and going after their goals. And so I think that too often funding becomes about personal relationships as opposed to really looking at the goals of the organization and how that fits within the broader movement. I think it also is important to think about systems change and how organizations fit within the broader systems that we're trying to shift. And so then it becomes much less a conversation about whether that organization is succeeding as opposed to whether that organization is filling a need in service of the broader goal. I know it's not like the magic bullet, but a couple of considerations at least.
Okay, thanks. Sandy, and then was there another?
I think there was a hand in Barcelona.
Sanjukta, you have a question? Okay, Sandy, go ahead then, Sanjukta.
Okay, well, following up on a bunch of these questions, you talk about the importance of building skills. I wonder how important is building networks to donors? And looking at human rights, one assumption is that there is a pretty static field of human rights donors. I'd like to hear your pushback on that. Let's think about a group in Hungary which isn't going to be able to raise much money from local donors. That's a subset, of the question of a steady state of resources. So often a path towards success for a group is to get into a pipeline where it's meeting the right individuals. And I know even for Open Society to figure out who to talk to in this building can be a challenge, and it helps to have the pathway openers. So I wonder how much you found out of that being important. Going back to the question about measuring impact, did you really find that the groups that are best able to measure their impact are the ones who succeed in communicating that to the donors, and a little bit more about how that happens? You talked about building the skills of leadership, and you mentioned the program director, maybe the IT director, maybe the COO. How about the development director and the major gifts development director? Do you need to have those people as well?
Good questions. So funding in the human rights space is tricky. There are many people who will say that human rights organizations will always be relying on philanthropic funding, that there is only a certain limited number of foundations that fund human rights work, and that's a limitation. I am an eternal optimist, and I believe two things about fundraising. One is that too often organizations focus on fundraising as the business of getting money. If you're doing fundraising right, it can also be in service of your mission. And every organization has to figure out a funding model that is going to both maximize their capital as well as maximize their ability to achieve their mission. So in the case of Spark, our grand fundraising strategy when we started the organization at the age of 25 was to make a list of all the rich people we knew in San Francisco and go ask them for money. That, first of all, didn't work. They didn't pick up our phone calls. And we realized very quickly that actually, going out and soliciting a donor to try and donate $10,000, which was a ton of money to us at the time, was not going to be as successful as getting 10 of our friends to go out and stretch themselves to get 10 of their friends to give $100. Because...
Hi, Hazel. Could you please mute your phone? Hazel, could you please mute your phone?
Oh,
although,
sorry.
If you've ever wondered what the stops are on one of the train lines in London, you know now.
Okay. Mind the gap.
That's okay. No worries. Just mute your phone. Thanks.
And so in the case of Spark, as I said, we developed a champions program where we got 10 of our friends to go out and commit to raising $1,000 each. And that brought in $10,000 for the organization. And to this day, the Champions Program remains a very important driver of Spark. And so not only are we bringing funding into the organization, we're also cultivating the next generation of philanthropists in the women's movement. And so it's an important mission-based fundraising strategy. Human Rights Watch has done a fabulous job of this, developing chapters all over the world, not just in the United States and Europe, but also looking at how they can cultivate human rights donors and a culture of philanthropy in Brazil, in South Africa, all over the world. So I think every organization needs to think about how they can be creative in their fundraising strategy and reaching into untapped donors, as well as funders need to be also cognizant of the fact that there is a role for funders to play in helping to introduce organizations that they support to other organizations that are funding them. Measuring impact, actually in the survey that I did, there was a very clear distinction between the organizations that said they began measuring their impact from day one versus the organizations that got to it later on. And so when I saw this data, I thought, well, that makes sense, because those are the organizations that are able to go to talk to donors about their data, and then those are the ones that get funded, and so that's why they grow more quickly. But when I went out and did my interviews, it wasn't the case at all. And don't get me wrong, donors want data, but these leaders were absolutely obsessed with whether or not they were having an impact, because like Tess Reynolds from New Door Ventures said, it's really hard to go out and raise $1 million. And if I'm going to go out and raise $1 million, I need to know that that is having the most possible impact that it can. So organizations like Braven were not just, Braven is an organization that helps support low-income college students to get jobs and to graduate more quickly. They weren't just satisfied looking at their assessments going up in their students. They wanted to test to see that it was actually a result of their intervention. And so they found a control group of students who weren't able to take their class for whatever reason, and then they tested it. They gave them $25 Amazon gift cards, and then they surveyed them every few months alongside with their students. And so it's thinking of these ways that organizations can be more rigorous about their impact that helps them ultimately, and not only just prove that what they're doing is working, but improve their programs as they grow. And then finally, development directors. I mean, I would say that is just an organizational dependent thing. I mean, like many organizations, their leaders will say that they're going to be their best development directors, and that development directors are really tricky because it actually takes, they say, a year and a half for them to make up their salary, and it also is one of the positions that has the highest turnover in the nonprofit sector, and so a lot of them are leaving after a year. So. So development directors, often organizations don't get to them until later.
Okay.
Can I answer all three?
Thanks. Sanjukta, thanks you, by the way, for staying late in Barcelona.
No worries, it's okay. It's a quick walk back home, and I can walk through the beautiful Barcelona rain right now. Okay. So just by way of quick introduction, I work as a program specialist for our European program, the Office Society Initiative for Europe. And one of the aspects of work I will be involved in this year is our work on building social movements. We call it movement infrastructure building. So I wanted to basically understand, I had two questions. One of them is, what are the distinctions that you see between social movements versus startups? And now that we're discussing the sustainability of startups, what role could donors play in turning a startup into a for-profit, or at least a portion of a startup into like a profit-generating, so at least they have some way of enabling their own sustainability rather than constantly relying on donors? And could that form part of a successful fundraising strategy? And my second question was, so we keep talking about data and measuring impact, and this being the burden of the organization itself. But the thing is, We do a lot of our own internal assessments to measure the impact of the grants themselves, but as our role in the field as a partner, as a key player, not only in terms of getting money, but we also, you know, host convenings, we do our own advocacy, so we're kind of in there as well. So basically, as a devil's advocate, does all of this impact measurement need to be on the startup or the organization or, you know, the grantee themselves? And what role could we take on as a donor to facilitate that and to, you know, allow for impact measurement to be done on both sides, but also to serve each other?
Great question. So movement building has been, I mean, it's been so interesting. There's a new book coming out by Henry Timms, who has at the 92nd Street Y here in New York. And, you know, he's talking about this form of movement building as a new power, that Me Too, that Occupy Wall Street, that, you know, Black Lives Matter, that all these movements have been really an example of how technology can be used to facilitate movement building like never before. I think that all of that is true. And we also need the organizations to be strong to put action into, to turn that kind of movement building into action, whether it's policy change, advocacy, whether it's you know, providing opportunities to harness that energy and support of, you know, more tangible volunteer efforts. And so I think that both are critical, and that that funders have an important role to play in figuring out where are the leverage points that can harness that energy to turn it into action. On the question of developing sustainable forms of revenue, in general, or the organizations that I found were that were raising money while we're figuring out, we're testing, using these ideas of testing, and that we often apply in programming to fundraising as well, and testing out different strategies to see what would work, whether it was earned income, philanthropic income. And so, for example, Hot Bread Kitchen, an organization in Harlem that serves low-income women to help them get into the food industry, was trying to think about how they could make themselves fully sustainable. And so they started testing out earned income strategies like selling bread, like doing wholesale sales to Whole Foods and JetBlue, like doing, they created an incubator. And all of that was funding them, but they realized that by not accepting philanthropic support, that they were selling their programs short. So for example, their philanthropy was important to provide childcare so that the organization could support the women more effectively. That it was important for keeping the women in the program longer than was maybe profitable, but was ultimately better for those women. And so thinking about philanthropy as bridging the gap to help fill the market. I mean, we can't solve market problems with market-based solutions. I mean, and this is an example of, like, you know, human rights failures are a failure in the market. There's not going to be a market to solve that problem. And so, or I in the book, I advocate for organizations testing earned income where they can, but I think that as a sector, we also have to acknowledge the limitations of earned income and where certain sectors like human rights and democracy might be less amenable to testing some of those solutions. And then finally, impact measurement and how funders can support measuring impact, absolutely critical. There's some great examples of this. Tipping Point in San Francisco, Robinhood here in New York, both focused primarily on poverty alleviation. And so they have a standard of measurement that they're trying to collect for all of their grantees to standardize tracking whether they are actually achieving their mission, not only on an individual organizational basis, but for the entire city of New York and San Francisco. So it's a great example of how funders can use the resources that they have to track progress toward the broader mission of the organizations as well as of the foundation, And do it in a way that is supportive of grantees and not taking away from their resources.
I think this is, as you've been talking, I think one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is, I think you bring throughout the book a skepticism, right? You're not claiming that you've figured out the way that an organization succeeds, nor that we as funders should be going out and finding the organizations that already have all these traits mm-hmm. and funding them, right? So that when it comes to assessment, the most important thing I hear you saying is that the leadership or the people in that organization say, I want to know if what we're doing is making a difference, right? Mm-hmm. That key insight is the most important thing, and then they'll figure out how to measure it, not just say, yeah, I assume it's working. Though I do kind of like the hugs as metric.
Yeah, I know. The hugs are good too.
Actually, I will admit that I'm right. How people react to you, I think, can be a measure, but it should be the only measure.
Yes.
And I really think that throughout this, one thing you said earlier is, when it comes to organizations in other countries, this book, they may read this and say, you know what, this is very US-centric. But that the key there is in seeing it as a collection of ideas that people can translate for themselves. Mm-hmm. And some, I think the reaction as I read it, some I thought, this just doesn't apply in so many contexts where we write work. And in others I thought, that's an interesting idea. And that's really what I would urge you as you pick up the book and read it as something that can spark new ideas, new thinking, or confirm some thinking that you've already done about programs. Because whether it's reading a chapter, just one chapter on its own, mining the footnotes to learn more about different collections of ideas that you've found, it's just full of ideas, full of insights. That I think are really useful, whether you're working with startup organizations, right? Whether it's a sex worker collective in Zambia or an established legal organization that's been around for 20 years in Europe or an organization in the United States. I think there's a lot here. This doesn't answer every question, but I really hope that as people delve themselves into the book, they're going to find what I found, which is a book that gets you thinking in old ways and new ways, and both questioning assumptions and confirming some ideas. So I really want to thank you for coming to OSF, and thanks to everybody here for coming. I also want to thank Beth Dunlap from New Enterprise, who wanted to be here and then realized after we set the time that her flight from home from her vacation lands this evening, not today. But she really, when I went to Beth and said, so I heard about this book, she pulled a copy out of her book backpack and it was all marked up and posted and things like that. So I really also want to encourage people who are here to, as you're working with startups, remember that we actually have somebody on our staff full time, she and Lauren from her team, who are here to really help be thought partners in how to support, how to do what I think Kate's question is raising as a concern. How do we help the organizations that may not already be there develop some of the skills and sensibilities that you've identified, rather than just going with the typical organizations that have already figured these things out, because that's too rare a thing, and that's not the world we want to live in. So
100%.
Thank you again to Kathleen and to everybody, and to those of you, Danny, Joanna, Sanjukta. I saw Nancy Yuman on the phone for a while, so thanks to all of you for joining, and have a good week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.